This is April 13th, 2014. And today I'm going to talk about breath practice. This may be the first teisha I've ever given on breath practice, which is kind of amazing because it's the most basic Zen practice. Not only Zen, but in other Buddhist forms of Buddhist meditation, it's a very basic practice. Maybe that I haven't given one on this because it is it's such a simple practice. And by simple, I don't mean easy. It's not easy, but it's uncomplicated. Today I'm going to, there are three aspects or three variations of breath practice. People at yesterday's workshop would have heard this, of course. There's counting the breath in two different ways, and then there is the following of the breath. And I'm going to, just for simplicity's sake, I'm going to just focus on following the breath. The other two are just nuances of difference from following the breath. I'm going to read from a couple of sources. This is a this is an article that appeared in a journal. I guess it's a Buddhist journal from almost 20 years ago, but it could have been 2,000 years ago because there's nothing time sensitive about following the breath. It's been around a long time. And it's a really, really excellent article by one of the most esteemed teachers in Theravadan Buddhism. His name is Bhante Hanepola Gunaratana. And he may be Sri Lankan. He's from Southeast Asia, I think. And I'm told that he's one of the several most highly regarded of the Theravadan Southeast Asian Buddhist teachers. So I'll just dive in here, commenting on this as we go along. Ancient Pali texts, Pali, P-A-L-I, where it was the language in which the original teachings of the Buddha appeared. Later they were translated into Sanskrit and then from there to Chinese and Japanese and Korean and Tibetan and so forth. But the earliest language was Pali. Ancient Pali texts liken meditation to the process of taming a wild elephant. The procedure in those days was to tie a newly captured animal to a post with a good strong rope. I'm asking listeners to see if you can get beyond sentimental feeling sorry for the elephant and get into just the metaphor of it. I myself kind of flinched at the thought of this magnificent animal being trained this way, but I'll just keep going. When you do this, the elephant is not happy. He screams and tramples and pulls against the rope for days. Finally, it sinks through his skull that he can't get away, and he settles down. At this point, you can begin to feed him and to handle him with some measure of safety. Eventually, you can dispense with the rope and post altogether and train your elephant for various tasks. Now you've got a tamed elephant that can be put to useful work. In this analogy, the wild elephant is your wildly active mind, the rope is mindfulness, and the post is our object of meditation, our breathing. The tamed elephant who emerges from this process is a well-trained, concentrated mind that can then be used for the exceedingly tough job of piercing the layers of illusion that obscure reality. Meditation tames the mind. I suppose there could be people who would say, well, why does the mind need taming? Well, I don't know that we can even have any conversation. If you think that your mind is fine as it is, no one listening to this, I think, would take that position. In the early days of the center, our introductory workshop brochures would mention mind control, learning to control the mind. And Roshi Kapo changed that because it sounds, well, too controlling. But when we become proficient at breath practice, this is a way of managing or controlling the mind. I think the misunderstanding would come to think that there's an I who's controlling it. It's not the I that's controlling it. We'll get into this more later. But it comes under our control. It becomes something useful to us, the mind, through breath practice. So we need to tame the elephant. In Zen, we have the image of taming the ox. In that analogy, the idea that the ox is the mind, but it has this dual nature of our restless, unmanageable mind, and at the same time our true mind, because they're not two. Ultimately, there's nothing outside our true mind, but one aspect of that true mind is this restless. Restless mind, monkey mind, it's often referred to in the old texts. And the ox really can represent both. And then the task is to tame this ox that keeps wanting to wander off, and you just keep having to pull it back and pull it back. So it's a slightly different analogy than the one of the static post in the ground. Here, we are working with it on a tether of some kind, and we keep bringing the ox back onto the path rather than letting it wander anywhere it wants to. Now, to be fair to the author, the first paragraph is about locating the breath, the movement of the breath at the nostrils, which is not Zen advice. I've never heard of that in Zen, where you focus on the movement, the passage of air at the nostrils. So I'm just going to skip that. I'm sure it works, but I'm too sold on Zen as a system on its own to try to mix this up. I think we can really get into trouble when we start mixing up different types of Buddhist meditation. It's not that important. So we left off. Meditation tames the mind. You watch the entire movement of breath with clear and collected attention. Make no attempt to control the breath. Now let me repeat that. Make no attempt to control the breath. This is not a breathing exercise of the sort done in yoga. What comes to mind there with that reference is pranayama, where you close one nostril with your hand and breathe very vigorously and deeply, and then you close the other nostril and breathe through the other one. I've never tried this, but it's a yoga practice. This is not a breathing exercise of the sort done in yoga. Focus on the natural and spontaneous movement of the breath. Natural and spontaneous movement of the breath. Don't try to regulate it. or emphasize it in any way. Most beginners have some trouble in this area. In order to help themselves focus on the sensation, they unconsciously accentuate the breathing. The result is a forced and unnatural effort that actually inhibits concentration rather than helping it. Don't increase the depth of your breath or its sound. This latter point is especially important in group meditation. Loud breathing can be a real annoyance to those around you. Just let the breath move naturally as if you were asleep. Let go and allow the process to go along at its own rhythm. He mentions sleep here. I sometimes bring this up when guiding people on breath practice, is that it can help to remember that our breath does very well on its own when we're sound asleep every night. It has a way of filling the lungs and being expelled, filling the lungs and being expelled, and so forth. The point being that we don't need to control it. It's does just fine without our trying to manipulate or regulate or control it in any way. Now, beginners who hear this understand what I'm saying, but it's a different matter to really to do the following of the breath and not try to control it. But let him speak more. This is such a good article. Let go. There's the key word, let go. Let go and allow the process to go along at its own rhythm. This sounds easy, but it is trickier than you think. Do not be discouraged if you find your own will getting in the way. Just use that as an opportunity to observe the nature of conscious intention. Watch the delicate interrelation between the breath, the impulse to control the breath, and the impulse to cease controlling the breath. You may find it frustrating for a while, but it is highly profitable as a learning experience, and it is a passing phase. Eventually, the breathing process will move along under its own steam, and you will feel no impulse to manipulate it. At this point, you will have learned a major lesson about your own compulsive need to control the universe. This is a major issue for all of us when we begin practice, and possibly for years beyond our beginning, is this illusion of control, and that there's an I who can control things in some absolute way. It's not that we have no control over the process. We have some freedom of choice as to where we direct our attention. We can exercise some will. When thoughts come into the mind, we have the choice to swing our attention back to the breath. But too many of us as beginners think that it's all in our hands, and it's not all in our hands. This is a huge thing that may take us years to learn this little by little, that we're not in control in any absolute sense. This can be the single biggest obstacle for anyone practicing meditation, whether it's breath or a koan practice, shikantaza, or anything else, is relinquishing this habit of trying to control everything, control the results. The only thing we really can control is our effort, our persistent, sincere effort, our earnestly returning again and again to the breath. That we have some control over, but beyond that, it's pretty much out of our hands. When you first begin this procedure, expect to face some difficulties. Your mind will wander off constantly, darting around like a bumblebee and zooming off on wild tangents. Try not to worry. The monkey mind phenomenon is well known. It is something that every advanced meditator has had to deal with. They have pushed through it one way or another, and so can you. When it happens, gently but firmly, without getting upset or judging yourself for straying, simply return to the simple physical sensation of the breath. Then do it again the next time, and again, and again, and again. He refers to the simple physical sensation of the breath. I always found that it's kind of a, for me, it is more of a kind of an internal hearing of the breath. You're not literally hearing it, because it can get so soft, it's inaudible, but you're kind of hearing it in your mind's ear. The point is not to get too precise, trying to be too precise about what type of awareness it is, the sensation or the internal hearing or anything else. It's awareness. That's the point. Any way that you can maintain awareness of it is going to work. Somewhere in this process, you will come face to face with a sudden and shocking realization that you are completely crazy. Your mind is a shrieking, gibbering madhouse on wheels, barreling pell-mell down the hill, utterly out of control and hopeless. About being crazy, I brought to mind these words of Plato: when the mind is thinking, it is talking to itself. No problem. You are not crazier than you were yesterday. It has always been this way, and you just never noticed. You are also no crazier than everybody else around you. The only real difference is that you have confronted the situation. They have not. So they still feel relatively comfortable. That does not mean they are better off. Ignorance may be bliss, but it does not lead to liberation. So don't let this realization unsettle you. It is a milestone, actually, a sign of real progress. The very fact that you have looked at the problem straight in the eye means that you are on your way up and out of it. This is possibly the most important advice that any practitioner can take to heart, is that it doesn't matter how distracted you may think. Shouldn't be your concern. Because we can't, the meditator herself or himself can't judge, can't appraise the quality of sitting, except, well, one way you can, the only way I've ever learned that's the least bit reliable is that if you find that time is really dragging and you're just sitting and asking, when is that timer ever going to hit the bell? Just do me a favor, hit the bell. If you're doing that, then you're on the surface. And you don't need to be. You just need to forget about the timer. Forget about time. Just pour yourself into the breath. That's the only indication that I've ever heard or thought of where you can get a reliable evaluation of the quality of your sitting. And notice I say, if time seems to drag, the converse isn't necessarily true. If time just vanishes, that doesn't mean necessarily that you're in a really clear, concentrated state, because we can go off into weird states of mind where time vanishes and it's not great quality. So the best thing is to just relinquish any efforts at evaluating your mind, your meditation. There's an old saying in Buddhism, the eye cannot see itself, the tongue cannot taste itself. In the same way, no one of us can really be an accurate judge of our practice. It doesn't matter. Okay, all right, let's say your concentration is terrible. You do the same thing. You go back to the breath. Don't waste time in these metrics. Just go back to the breath. It doesn't matter. Who is this person you're thinking of? You know, my practice is bad. My mind is a mess. That's the problem right there. You must learn to refrain from judging your practice. This is a huge, huge thing, especially for Americans, it seems. I've said this before, but it's worth repeating, that Asian teachers, I've often heard them say that the biggest obstacle for Americans is this critical inner voice, this inner critical voice, this judging, criticizing oneself. So that's possibly the biggest challenge for Americans or anyone else, maybe to get free of it. And that just takes time. It usually takes a long time to not listen to that critical voice and just go back to the breath. Okay, the last sentence he said, the very fact that you have looked at the problem straight in the eye means that you are on your way up and out of it. Don't set goals for yourself that are too high to reach. Be gentle with yourself. You are trying to follow your own breathing continuously and without a break. That sounds easy enough, so you will have a tendency at the outset to push yourself to be scrupulous and exacting. This is unrealistic. Take time in small units instead. At the beginning of an inhalation, make the resolve to follow the breath just for the period of that one inhalation. Even this is not so easy, but at least it can be done. Then at the start of the exhalation, resolve to follow the breath just for that one exhalation all the way through. You will still fail repeatedly, but keep at it. Zen Master Dogen has referred to Zen practice as a practice of continual failure. If only people could take that to heart and realize how normal that is, how expected that is, and just, if nothing else, just as a way to stop beating up on yourself and finding fault with yourself, you will still fail repeatedly, but keep at it. And most of this, by the way, is advice for people working on a koan as well. It's hardly different at all. The same neurotic tendencies play out as we're trying to concentrate on a koan and find ourselves, the mind, continuously wandering. Every time you stumble, start over. Take it one breath at a time. This is the level of the game where you can actually win. Stick with it. Fresh resolve with every breath cycle. Tiny units of time. I'm just going to pause here and read some words of the Sufi mystic Rumi, great master in Islam. The Sufi tradition has been likened to Zen just in the sense that the Sufism is the mystic sect of Islam, just as Zen has been sometimes called the mystic school of Buddhism. Mystic basically meaning where it's based on direct experience, not texts, learning, memorizing, studying, but just direct experience. Anyway, Rumi, sometimes you can take these words of his as a encouragement if you lose your way or just get so busy that you leave the Zen Center and for months or years at a time, or decades, it doesn't matter, as encouragement to just come back. Don't make too big a deal out of it. But I think it also works, I mean, it does also work, in terms of just how many times the mind wanders from the practice, from the breath. This is what he says. Come, whoever you are. Wanderer, worshiper, lover of leaving, it doesn't matter. Ours is not a caravan of despair. Come even if you have broken your vow 1,000 times. Come, yet again. Come. And then Gunaratana continues, stick with it, fresh resolve with every breath cycle, tiny units of time. Observe each breath with care and precision, taking it one split second on top of another, with fresh resolve piled on top of the other, one on top of the other. In this way, continuous and unbroken awareness will eventually result. This meditation is a process of retaining the mind. The state you are aiming for is one in which you are totally aware of everything that is happening in your own perceptual universe, exactly the way it happens, exactly when it is happening. Total, unbroken awareness in present time. This is an incredibly high goal, and not to be reached all at once. It takes practice, so we start small. We start by becoming totally aware of one small unit of time, just one single inhalation. And when you succeed, you are on your way to a whole new experience of life. I sometimes say at workshops that we can think of the breath as the most comprehensive, the most fundamental medium of meditation. It's not just used in various kinds of Buddhist meditation, but in other, or in yes, yoga, we said, but in other kinds of meditation too. What is this great significance of the breath? Well, it occupies this joining position, this uniting position. We can think of it as kind of a swinging door between these different polarities, these different things that we think of as opposites. So, for example, inside and outside. The breath partakes of both. Conscious and unconscious. We touched on that. Voluntary and involuntary. It's both. There's the voluntary effort of returning again and again to the breath, but the breath functions beautifully on its own as well. It's the mind that gets into problems, the thoughts that get into cause problems. And when you consider that when we're breathing, whether we're using it as in meditation or not, when we're breathing, we are sharing. We are uniting with all beings. We are literally inhaling the breath of all beings and exhaling into the breath of all beings. Before I get into that more, I feel obliged to mention that the danger of breath practice, and this is, I suppose, the danger of any practice, is to use it as just a relaxation practice, just to reduce the stress in your life, become more calm. Relax. We want to relax. We have to relax. Meditation, there's no mature, seasoned meditation practice without relaxing, without relaxation. But if we settle for relaxation as the goal, of our aspiration in practice, then we are denying ourselves far greater possibilities. And I have to say, I don't personally know of anyone who is doing a breath practice who came to awakening from that. There's no reason that you couldn't, because remember, we are in our true nature, we are already enlightened. This is our nature. Our what we call our Buddha nature, our true nature. So you can come to awakening even without meditation. There are rare stories of people who have had these spontaneous enlightenment experiences and they weren't doing any kind of meditation. But I think you're more people doing breath practice are more vulnerable, let's say, to sinking into meditation as merely a relaxation practice. There's a term that appears in the Three Pillars of Zen when Yasutani Roshi is talking about the different levels of meditation, and the Japanese word is bonpu Zen, which is doing Zen practice just to improve your physical and mental health. It's a way of becoming more integrated, more calm, and more centered, more emotionally stable, more concentrated. These are wonderful things. But they all are, they all will come to you, even if your aspiration is beyond those things. They are secondary things. They are byproducts of aspiration to enlightenment. The one thing that breath practice, you could say that breath practice and koan practice both at base are concentration practices, but the one distinguishing element in a koan practice is the element of questioning, which really is not part of breath practice. You didn't hear him referring to questioning. That is the key distinction of a koan practice, is that element of questioning, which even that isn't something that you have to bring into working on a koan, but it is what really gets you airborne with a koan, really can make the difference in terms of a breakthrough, seeing through discriminating consciousness, seeing through birth and death, is that element of questioning. Those rare cases I mentioned a minute ago of people who came to enlightenment without any kind of meditation, the ones I know of, there are only two or three of them I've ever heard of, they were questioning profoundly. It just came to them naturally. It gripped them, a question. One was the case of a college student in the 1940s, an American woman, who had this question come to her: what is real? What is real? And this bit into her with tremendous force. And after a few months of being absorbed in that question, she had what sounds like a really deep enlightenment experience. There's also the case of Ramana Maharshi, the great Indian sage, who was tormented with questions of death. And he lay down and just on his own, he was 16 years old. And he just on his own, nothing he'd ever heard of, he simulated rigor mortis. He said, okay, if I'm going to die, what is that? And he lay down and he imagined himself as dead. And that drew him into the most profound questioning that resulted in a tremendous experience of enlightenment. So what koan practice offers is this element of questioning. You don't have to be doing it. You don't want to be doing it if it feels contrived, if it feels artificial when you're working on a koan to try to, you know, make yourself question. But if you just stay with the pure concentration on the koan, then sooner or later it is likely to morph into a question. In either case, whether you're doing breath practice or koan practice, whether you're questioning the koan or not, the most important thing is to trust the process. This comes to me more and more and more in recent years, is that phrase, to trust the process. It runs all through the article I just read. That's what he's saying. Don't worry about how you think you're doing. Just trust the process of persevering at it day in and day out, and it will carry you through. I have a passage here by Rainer Maria Rilke about this trusting the process, and it's a poem called The Swan. This clumsy living that moves lumbering as if in ropes through what is not done reminds us of the awkward way the swan walks, and to die, which is the letting go of the ground we stand on and cling to every day, is like the swan when he nervously lets himself down into the water which receives him gaily, and which flows under and after him wave after wave, while the swan, unmoving and marvelously calm, is pleased to be carried each moment, more fully grown, more like a king, farther and farther on. This beautifully captures what is possible, what will happen if we trust the process of following the breath or the koan and relinquish this need to control things with this discriminating mind. I want to close with a passage from Joanna Macy in her marvelous book, World as Lover, World as Self, where she's talking about the significance of the breath. Joanna Macy is one of the great guides of engaged Buddhism and the environment and the threats to the environment, and she has come up with a number of meditations of her own about realizing to some degree, remembering, recognizing our connection with all beings. And there are various ones in here, but this one is about the breath. And I'll just read it. It stands on its own. The sheer chemistry of life gives us cause to meditate on our interexistence with all beings through time. Consider our breathing, which might appear the most personal and intimate of acts, since the atoms of oxygen we draw into our lungs move on to sustain each cell in our innermost body and brain. Yet that very breathing links us directly and immediately with beings of the past and future. In each sniff and sigh and lungful, they participate. Wondrous are the mathematical givens of our presence to each other in this way. Reflect on the fact that the average breath you breathe contains about 10 sextillion atoms. Now reflect on the amazing fact that the Earth's atmosphere itself is of a size to contain the same number of breaths. This remarkable symmetry, which places you midway between atom and world, also means that with each inhalation you take in an average of one, that with each inhalation you take in an average of one atom from each of the breaths in our world, and with each exhalation send back the same average of an atom to each breath. This exchange, repeated 20,000 times a day by each of the Earth's billions of people, produces such an interbreathing that, as scientists conclude, each breath you breathe must contain a quadrillion atoms breathed by the rest of humankind within the past few weeks, and more than a million atoms breathed personally sometime by each and any person on Earth. The circulation of air through normal atmospheric turbulence provides the diffusion that allows this to be so, as scientist Guy Murchie explains. And he goes on to evoke what this can mean. This is Guy Murchie speaking. Your next breath will include a million odd atoms of oxygen and nitrogen once breathed by Pythagoras, Socrates, Confucius, Moses, Columbus, Einstein, or anyone you can think of. And going on to animals, you may add a few million molecules from the mighty blowings of the whale that swallowed Jonah, from the snorts of Mohammed's white mare, from the restive raven that Noah sent forth from the ark. And then she just ends, by the same token, atoms of each breath you breathe will find their way into the lungs of beings yet to come in whatever century they may walk this earth. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.